Okay, we'll call our next case, which is case number 74912, Christina Paulus versus PHG1 LLC et al. And on the council here we have, Mr. Smith representing the appellant, Mr. Anderson, and Mr. Schmober representing the respondents. Okay, Mr. Smith, did you want to reserve any time in rebuttal?
Yes, at least 5 minutes, please.
Thank you. You may do so. You may proceed. Mr. Polzenberg is here as well for the appellant.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Gibbons. May it please the court. Christina Paulus, an indigent woman suffering a psychotic episode, was pinned to scorching asphalt and held handcuffed for more than 5 minutes, causing second and third degree burns across her body. Ms. Paulus brought federal civil rights claims, but we're not here to relitigate those. She has rights under state law that have never been litigated, and that Judge Baer initially recognized as viable, but then he got spooked that he might run afoul of Judge Mahan's decision. That was his mistake. Number one, the Ninth Circuit did not affirm ground the aspect of Judge Mahan's decision that Judge Baer thought was issue preclusive, and that Metro argued was issue preclusive. And second, the objective reasonableness standard for a Fourth Amendment excessive force claim, which was Ms. Paulus' federal claim, is not the same issue as the standard for a simple negligence claim under Nevada common law. So I'll start with the issue, the federal issue preclusion.
Are the facts the same? Are the underlying facts the same?
Yes, the underlying incident is the same. However, you have to understand that for the federal civil rights action, the court's only looking at an intentional reckless or grossly negligent application of intentional force. So there could be aspects of the officer's actions that simply aren't considered in that analysis. You'll notice that in Judge Mahan's decision, he considers the 2 minutes and 40 seconds after backup arrives. But in that circumstance, there's a question whether there's even an intentional application of force at that time. So that would be something that the jury could consider in the negligence claim that wasn't considered in the federal civil rights action. On the overarching issue of what the Ninth Circuit actually did, there's no question that there's consensus both as to the law and how it applies to these facts. The Ninth Circuit affirmed only the grant of qualified immunity, meaning that there was no clearly established precedent establishing the unconstitutionality of the officer's actions. It did not reach the separate question of whether there was, in fact, a constitutional violation because the officer's conduct was objectively unreasonable. And there's consensus both within the Ninth Circuit and throughout the federal judiciary that when the Circuit Court of Appeals only affirms one of two alternative grounds, that the ground that is not affirmed is not issue preclusive. Now, turning to the difference of the standards. Now, that's an issue of federal law, although it's clear how that law applies. There's also the question under state law of whether the issues of negligence and Fourth Amendment excessive force are, in fact, the same issue. They're not. Just a couple of examples. Under the Graham versus Connor standard objective unreasonableness standard, the court describes that as a balancing test. You balance the nature and quality of the Fourth Amendment violation against the intrusion into an individual's Fourth Amendment rights against the government's interests. That becomes clear in Judge Mahan's decision that what he's doing is a different kind of balancing test, the kind that the jury would not be required to perform in undertaking a simple negligence analysis. For example, just on the nature of the intrusion, he looks at the moment when Officer Baca initially takes her to the ground and applies that force. He says, well, I consider that minimal force. And the reason is because at that time, it doesn't result in immediate injury the way shooting someone or beating someone with your police baton would. However, that doesn't take account the way you would in a negligence action over time, how those injuries would become more severe, even life-threatening, the way they do, as everyone knows, in Las Vegas in the middle of the summer. The second example would be the evaluating the government interest. Under the Graham versus Connor test, resisting arrest is automatically credited towards the government. So that weighs against there being a finding of excessive force. It doesn't take any account into the reason why somebody might be have a good reason for resisting arrest, such as when you're being asked to place your body against hot asphalt. That simply doesn't enter the analysis. But a jury, considering all of the facts and circumstances, could determine that perhaps it was negligent to continue to push Ms. Paulus into the ground even after the point when it becomes clear that it's hurting her. The biggest difference, though, is just that federal courts have recognized that the Fourth Amendment standard is really one of gross negligence or recklessness. It's not a simple negligence standard. That's why we've cited all the cases that find that state courts do not apply issue preclusion when a federal court has dismissed a federal civil rights claim and remanded to the state court for consideration of the state law claims. We're not saying that there might be other issues that could be precluded were there to be other claims that more closely match the Fourth Amendment claim. But in this circumstance, there's no exact match the way you need for issue preclusion between the Fourth Amendment claim and the negligence claim.
But didn't they, wasn't it pled pretty much the same conduct? The Fourth Amendment reasonableness the same as state law negligence? Here the conduct was identical?
Not quite.
In the pleading, pretty much?
No, because in the complaint, you'll notice that the civil rights claim, that's pleaded in terms of an excessive application of force. That's talking about the intentional application of force. When we get to the negligence claim, we're talking about the failure to exercise reasonable care, which could include that span during the 2 minutes and 40 seconds where she's just left lying on the ground. Not necessarily that there may be a fact dispute as to whether she's actually being pushed into the ground, but even if Metro is standing back, there becomes a fact question as to whether it was reasonable to just to leave her even without continuing to apply intentional force. Turning briefly to the question of the negligent training and supervision claims, discretionary immunity, as this court articulated in the Martinez case, requires two things. Not only does the act be an issue of discretion, but also that the discretionary act involve a policy question, specifically social, economic, or political policy. And here we have both problems. One, that there is, in fact, a policy. The department policy is to get the detainees off of the asphalt as soon as possible. And there's a fact question whether Officer Baca's failure to do that was the result of negligent training. And the second issue is that this isn't a question of political, economic, or social policy. This is the exact kind of claim that you would bring against a private security firm, just as we're bringing these claims against the Palms for ordinary negligence and failing to get somebody off of hot asphalt as soon as it is reasonably safe to do so.
Isn't that an evaluation that the officer makes there at the scene based on all the circumstances, and doesn't that then imply there's some discretion going on?
Well, I think that the policy itself articulates what the officer can and cannot do. I think there's a fact question whether he violated that policy. Now, there may be questions of discretion in how you apply a particular policy, but here I think the jury could find that he simply violated department policy. The policy was to get the detainee off of the asphalt immediately, and he did not do that. And I think that raises the fact question whether, even though the department had this policy,
is the policy to remove them immediately or as soon as you can safely do so?
Well, there you have both examples in the record. Sergeant Harney, I believe, says it's when it's reasonably safe to do so. I believe it's Officer Swan in his deposition says that it's immediately. But even if it were just when it's safe to do so, I think then there becomes a fact question whether Officer Baca followed that policy when backup had arrived, and the backup officers also did not do anything, even though she was fully restrained.
So it's my understanding, based at least based on Judge Mahan's findings,
right,
that it's was about 2.5 minutes or so after the backup officers arrived.
Correct.
When she was moved off the pavement.
Correct.
Okay. So we're talking about whether the delay of 2.5 minutes was unreasonable.
Well, both whether that delay was unreasonable and whether if that was a violation of department policy, which we're contending it is, whether that indicates an inadequate training or supervision on the part of Officer Bakker. He also did not submit a use of force report even after it became clear that Ms. Powles did suffer these injuries because his supervisor told him not to.
Did you want to reserve the balance?
I would like to reserve the balance of my time.
Very well. Thank you. You may do so. Okay. Mr. Anderson.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Craig Anderson on behalf of Officer Baca from the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. I'm going to take somewhere between 8 and 10 minutes. I'll try to stop myself, and then the Palms will take the remaining time. As Your Honors have pointed out, the facts in this case are the same as the facts in the federal case, and the allegations for negligence are the same. Where this is different is the plaintiff's, or Ms. Paulos, is correct when she states that in a deadly force situation, a court looks at the totality of the circumstances in evaluating a negligence versus a Fourth Amendment claim. That's not the situation we're dealing here. If you look at the Hayes case, the Voss case, and the other cases cited by the plaintiff, they are all very specific that they are deadly force cases. Those are what are known as the provocation line of cases, where an officer who uses an otherwise justified use of force negligently provoked the violent confrontation. They're not alleging that here. There's no dispute that the officers had the right to take Ms. Paulos into custody. There's no dispute that they had the right to handcuff her and to use reasonable force in doing so. Their complaints are that after, Ms. Paulos' complaints are that after she was handcuffed, she was left on the ground for 2.5 minutes. And that is the negligence. So it's not a use of force case. It's a negligent seizure case. Now, where the Ninth Circuit's order comes into play in this case is Judge Mahan clearly found that the officers acted reasonably under the circumstances, and he also found that in the alternative, there was qualified immunity because the law regarding detentions on pavement was not clearly established. The Ninth Circuit did not address the merits of the underlying violation. The panel only found that there was no clearly established law. But what qualified immunity is good faith immunity. So it protects officers who may violate the Constitution but do so in good faith and make a reasonable mistake. Nevada has an analogous provision in its discretionary immunity statute, NRS 41.032, that allows officers leeway as long as they're using their discretion unless they abuse that discretion. Now, this court has never addressed discretionary immunity in a seizure case or a negligent use of force case. The Ninth Circuit has. In three cases, Jones versus Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, Sandoval versus Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, and Davis versus City of Las Vegas, it found that an officer is entitled to discretionary immunity under Nevada law as long as his actions are not in bad faith or malicious. So the qualified immunity finding by the Ninth Circuit in this case is essentially a finding that Officer Baca did not act in bad faith. That his actions, although maybe they were wrong, maybe they were negligent, were in good faith, and they would be protected by Nevada's discretionary immunity statute. And that was highlighted in the Hayes case, where the California Supreme Court wrote, law enforcement personnel have a degree of discretion as to how they choose to address a particular situation. Summary judgment is appropriate when the trial court determines that viewing the facts most favorably to the plaintiff, no reasonable jury could find negligence. In this case, no reasonable jury could find bad faith. That's already been decided by the Ninth Circuit in the qualified immunity argument. So, if there aren't any questions, I'd turn it over to the Palms, but I think this is a rather easy case on the issue of preclusion because of the discretionary immunity statute and how that interplays with qualified immunity.
Thank you very much. Okay, Mr. Schmurr, I neglected Mr. Brandon's here as well. Mr. Schmurr, go ahead.
Good afternoon, and may it please the Court, Justin Smurber on behalf of FCH1 LLC, the Palms, as well as Jeannie Houston individually.
If it pleases the court, I'd like to direct my argument in terms of three issues that are specific to my clients, as they are not involved in the Section 1983 claim. They were appealed and went to the Ninth Circuit. Those three issues would be the issues of residence of locator, the good faith defense, and legal duty that's been briefed under Lee versus GNLB Court. First, with regards to the issue of res ipsa locator, the appellant has raised this for the first time before this court. We raised this in our brief indicating this is something that wasn't pled, and they responded by indicating that this is a rule of evidence rather than a rule of pleading. While I do take some issue with that, my argument is much broader. Under the Aztec mining case and a litany of other cases from this court, a failure to raise a point or contention at the district court is a waiver for purposes of appeal. The fact that we are hearing this for the first time on appeal is a waiver situation. The second issue that I have with regards to the res ipsa is that the basis for a res ipsa claim is that the appellant has to show that the respondents, Palms, Metro, Jeannie Houston, are in a situation to better understand and explain the factual scenario regarding the causation of injuries. We simply don't have that situation here. The appellant has cited the case of Las Vegas Hospital Association, where an individual is rendered unconscious and wakes up with an injury. We don't have such a situation here because the appellant, Ms. Paulos, was conscious through her event. She's testified regarding how her event took place. She's testified regarding her car accident. She's testified regarding her detention, regarding how her burns occurred while she was being held to the asphalt. We don't have a situation where she can say, res ipsa locator applies because the respondents are in a better situation to understand the cause of the accident. It simply does not apply here. Moving to the good faith defense, Palms and Ms. Houston individually are asserting a good faith defense, saying that they responded and they became involved in this incident for one singular purpose. They were responding to a Metro officer's request for assistance. Under NRS 171-132, an officer or someone making an arrest can summon additional people for assistance. We also have no notation in the brief to NRS 190-193, which discusses the ability, that it is a misdemeanor crime to hinder an officer in carrying out its legal duties or its official duties. Here, the Palms and Ms. Houston are solely being held responsible in this case because they came to the aid of an officer. Well, this court in the Gross Gene matter said that while there may not be a qualified immunity available to a private actor such as Ms. Houston or the Palms, there is a good faith defense that can be raised. Now, the appellants raised the issue that that was made in the context of a Section 1983 claim and that that would not apply to a false imprisonment claim such as what we have here. And we also both briefed the Goodman case, which went up in front of the federal district court, where Judge Jones initially said that the good faith defense would apply to a false imprisonment, and then it was then overturned on reconsideration. Well, I think that this is an opportunity for a Nevada Supreme Court to address that and extend the good faith defense to common law claims. If we fail to do that, we are telling Nevada individuals, Nevada private citizens, Nevada businesses, go ahead, act in good faith, comply with NRS 171-132, assist law enforcement, and you'll have a good faith defense. But then when they do that, and they rely on that defense, they're going to be told, well, that defense only applies to Section 1983.
And what concerns me, counsel, about your argument is that some claims, like a false imprisonment claim, does not include intent as an element. And so I get your policy argument, but the purpose of the good faith defense is to assess the intent of the actor and they're in responding to the officer's request. Where you have a tort, false imprisonment is the one in this case, but suppose it's battery or assault or something similar. I'm not sure that the good faith defense extends in that circumstance.
And thank you.
Why should we?
Justice Arce, let me address that. Under the Hernandez City versus Reno case, the Nevada Supreme Court addresses what an appellant or a plaintiff his obligation is in terms of proving a false imprisonment claim. And what they say is it's necessary to prove that the person is restrained of his liberty without legal cause or justification. I view it differently. I view it that the good faith defense serves as that legal cause or justification for the private actor to become involved. They can rely on that and say, I am responding to an officer's request. I now have a legal cause or justification to become involved. And I think that that ties into my public policy argument, that if we were going to tell Nevada private citizens and business owners, go ahead and do the right thing and assist law enforcement in good faith, I don't think we can then turn and say, well, this is not going to apply to all the claims you're going to be sued with, because we know that every time there's a Section 1983 claim, there's going to be a false imprisonment and a defamation and a litany of other common law torts. So if we are to take that approach, that it is only going to go to the intent and it is only going to cover Section 1983 claims, we are essentially rendering that defense void for people. Lastly,
Security Officer Houston exceeds the request. I mean, suppose that it is she who forces Ms. Palace's face down on the hot pavement.
I think then...
You're asking us to provide you with essentially a complete defense or immunity simply on the request of the officer. But it seems like it would be a question of fact about whether the good faith's been exceeded. Even if that defense extended to a tort claim in which intent is not at issue.
Two things, Justice Hardesty. One, I agree with you. I agree that there is a determination to be made because it is still a good faith defense. Mm-hmm. It's not a carte blanche right to go act as a vigilante. So there is still an analysis to be made. And I think as you look at it in the specific facts of this case, I deposed their security expert and I've cited his testimony in the brief. Excessive use of force was not the issue. I asked him, do we have an excessive use of force?
No, his testimony, if I understand it, and maybe I got this wrong, focuses only on the, primarily on the placement of Ms. Palos on the pavement and the period of time after she was cuffed. That seems to be the focus of his opinion.
That is the focus of his opinion. And that's why I specifically, well, two things to address that.
This is an unusual case. We haven't had one quite like this where the focus of the issue has to do with that problem, not the alleged excessive force in the takedown in the first instance.
I understand. But in terms of what their expert said, and I was specific in questioning him regarding the timeline. His testimony is that the plaintiff should have been removed from the asphalt once backup officers arrived. I asked him if he had any criticisms before the backup officers arrived. Well, if you review the tape, Ms. Houston is only involved until backup officers arrive. She then removed herself from the situation. In fact, the appellate argues that, saying that that was a breach of duty because she abandoned the situation. Well, no, I think that goes back to the fact that it was a good faith defense. Once she was cuffed, once she was secured, she removed herself from the situation.
Mr. Smerber, I have a little different question. The court below granted Metro summary judgment and granted your client's joinder, but all the factual findings relate to Metro's argument and the issue preclusion argument, but there were no findings made by Judge Mahan about your clients at all. So how was that a basis for summary judgment?
Well, are you talking about on the federal level or Judge Baer at the district court level?
So Judge Baer here didn't make findings specific to your clients, and for that matter, neither did Judge Mahan, on whom Judge Baer relied. So what basis do I have in Judge Baer's order for summary judgment for your clients?
Because the basis of Judge Baer's ruling was that there was issue of preclusion because Judge Mahan had found that the arrest and detention of the appellate was reasonable.
Right. He didn't make any, but Judge Mahan didn't make any findings about your clients.
He did not. But my argument is our only involvement in this case was to assist Officer Baca in his arrest and detention of the appellate. And if you review Officer Baca's testimony, he says specifically, I effected that arrest. I was in control of that arrest. I was in control of the appellate. So if you are to find that his arrest and detention was reasonable, and my client's only involvement is to assist in that arrest and detention, then that must be applied to my client as well.
I don't see how we could say, well, your assistance in that is unreasonable, your actions were unreasonable.
But the overall Justice King issues question, you didn't argue that in the district court in front of Judge Baer. You were riding along with Metro.
We had
their arguments. You had joiners. I mean, to be honest with you, I'm hearing a very good argument for the first time.
We filed a joinder along with substantive arguments at the district court level. We had fully briefed the issue, indicating that our involvement was limited and that our involvement would not raise to an issue of negligence or false imprisonment because we were only following along with Metro's actions. I only have 30 seconds left. I'll leave it in case Mr. Anderson has anything to add.
Okay, apparently not. So thank you, Mr. Schmerb, Mr. Anderson. Mr. Smith, you have almost 5 minutes. Go ahead.
Thank you. Justice Kadish, Justice Hardesty, you are correct. These issues that we're hearing for the first time, actually some of these issues for the first time in oral argument, have not been evaluated by Judge Baer below and were not the basis for his decision, which was solely on issue preclusion. The correct course is to reverse the district court's order on the basis of issue preclusion and remand for Judge Baer to consider these arguments in the first instance.
Mr. Smith, why shouldn't we extend issue preclusion on qualified immunity to Metro and to the Metro officers in this case?
I'm sorry, can you say the question one more time?
Why shouldn't we extend issue preclusion based upon qualified immunity found by the Ninth Circuit to Metro and its officers in this case?
So this is the argument that Metro is making for the first time in oral argument. They didn't raise this in the briefs. But it's also a mistake because they're relying on cases that they say indicate that the only time an officer can be liable under Nevada negligence standards is when the officer has acted in bad faith.
Unless we equate the two. If we equate the two conduct, it seems like, and this gets into how we assess Pearson and Saucy, or however.
Right.
What is the difference in the test? Didn't Pearson suggest that it's not disjunctive?
So Pearson allowed the Ninth Circuit to only reach the question of qualified immunity, whether there was a clearly established precedent.
Right.
That's different from the question under discretionary immunity, NRS 41032, which asks whether there is a policy decision and a discretionary act. Here we've raised fact question whether Officer Bach in fact violated department policy, which would not be a discretionary act.
You made an important point in your opening with regard to the difference between hiring and supervision and training. Would that require us to revisit some aspects of Martinez and clarify that? Some federal courts have raised that distinction as well.
I don't think so. I think Martinez appropriately adopts the Berkowitz test, the Gobert-Berkowitz test, and makes clear that not only do you need that discretionary prong, you also need the policy-making prong. I think it's Judge Dorsey's decision in the Correa case that we've cited in our supplemental was a good explication of how to apply Martinez in these circumstances. So she, in fact, notes that the cases that they're citing to say that a decision on unqualified immunity automatically gets you past discretionary immunity under state law is, in fact, incorrect. Just briefly addressing the other issues, the good faith defense, this was, I believe, waived by Palms. They raised it for the first time in their reply brief to their joinder. It's not anywhere in their answer, even though it is, as they claim, an affirmative defense. And they're wrong about its application beyond the question of qualified immunity under 1983 claims. Judge Dew was correct in reconsidering the Goodman case to say that does not create, a good faith defense to state law claims. The whole purpose of the good faith immunity that this court adopted in Grosjean was to make sure that police officers and those that assist them are on a level playing field, that officers wouldn't get out on qualified immunity while private actors would still be in because they can't avail themselves of that defense. But that has no application to the state law claims where both the officers and the private security personnel are subject to the same standard. And as we pointed out in our briefs, it's not even clear that they're entitled to that defense as a matter of law, because Jenny Houston, in fact, went beyond what Officer Baca asked her to do. He says that he never asked her to hold her head down. And in fact, she never got permission to leave the scene, even though it was clear that he was winded and tired and unable, perhaps, to raise Ms. Palace to her feet himself.
As to the false imprisonment claim, I mean, given the findings made as to Metro's activities, that they acted reasonably, doesn't it seem counterintuitive to say, but Pond's employee should be responsible on a false imprisonment claim, even though Metro acted reasonably? If she, sorry.
I think on the issue preclusion question, I think it's still open whether the officers did act reasonably, and that would be the question on their negligence claim. But even assuming that the officers acted reasonably, the question in the false imprisonment claim isn't reasonableness. It's whether there is a detention without justification. Now, we could revisit the issue if in fact, this court reverses on issue preclusion, then we can raise all these issues in front of Judge Baer and have him actually issue a decision. But I would ask this court to remand so that these issues can be considered by the district court in the first instance. Thank you.
Good. Well, thank you very much. Thank all attorneys. Excellent arguments and briefs. Mr. Smith, thank you, and Mr. Bolzimer for taking this case from our pro bono program. We appreciate that, and give you a chance to argue it as well. So with that, the court will be in recess until the next call in court. Okay.